I'm Ginger. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for being here tonight. If you weren't here, I'd be talking to myself, which I really don't have much of a problem doing, but thank you for being here. There are only two things that I want to share tonight that I don't want to forget, and one of them is that I have not given thought to what I'm going to say. I know my story. I don't know what parts of my story I'm going to talk about. I don't know what I'm going to leave out. It's in God's hands, and whatever He directs me to say, I'm going to say. So if you've got a problem with it, you need to take it up with Him. And if anybody hears anything they needed to hear, you need to thank Him, because I'm shooting from the hip. I'll start off by saying my drinking history, as far as alcoholically drinking, or drinking at all, was very short. I didn't start drinking until I was 40 years old. And I drank alcoholically from the day I started drinking until I finally gave it up when I was 47. But what I'll talk about is that I was born an alcoholic, and my alcoholic thinking was a burden in my life from as long back as I can remember. I was born in Huntsville, Alabama in 1951. And if you didn't get that, that's just too bad. I have three brothers. I have two older brothers and one younger brother. My father, we were a Leave It to Beaver family. I had, my dad worked. He was the manager of the telephone company. My mother didn't work. She was the stay-at-home mom. And, you know, there were a couple things that happened to me young in life that imprinted me and my life and how I saw some things. But overall, my life was very normal. And until I was about 9, and my dad, we moved to Gadsden, Alabama, and my dad started drinking. His boss was an alcoholic, and it was horrible. It was horrible. I was the apple of my daddy's eye. You're going to hear me talk a lot about my father, and it's because of the role he played in my life, and not so much about my mother, but to tell you a little bit about my mother. She'll be 93 this year, and I love her dearly. She is, her name's Pee-wee. She's 4'11". She's 4'7" now. And I'm not. And she wears a size 4 shoe. I don't. And I was, when I was 12 years old, I was only an inch shorter than I am now. And my mother was down here. And for some reason, I always felt that I disappointed her because I wasn't the petite little mini me and the only daughter she had. And I certainly didn't see myself as being a feminine, petite little girl. I was, sometimes people say things and it can just be one word that really hurts. And my mother always pointed out to everybody how big I was instead of how tall I was. That would have made the world a difference to me because I felt huge. And growing up with three brothers and being in a neighborhood full of boys, I didn't have anybody else to compare myself to except for my mother. And I fell very short of that. And we are just two completely different people. My mother doesn't worry about anything. I worry about everything. The two words that my parents used to describe me when I was little was hard-headed and a worrywart. Now, the hard-headed part, I prefer to say determined, because I was born with an overabundance of determination. I still have it. I always had it. I was one of these, but why, but why, but why? You know, if I wanted something, I was going to get it. You know, square peg, round hole, give me that peg. It's going to fit. That's just the way I was. Very determined. And my father was a worrywart, which I see now is I was also born with an abundance of fear. I was afraid. I worried about everything. I worried that you weren't worrying enough about you. I worried that I wouldn't get something. I worried if I got it, I was going to lose it. I worried about everything. And my father was an alcoholic. Apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And when I was 9, his drinking became really, really evident and bad in our lives. And I was, you know, I was daddy's little girl. I ran tough with the boys. I played with the big dogs. My dad was so proud of me for my roughness. I loved to go hunting and fishing with him. And he was, I put him on a pedestal. And when he started drinking, I saw this person that I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated. My mother had told me once to please ask Daddy to stop drinking because you're the only person in the world he will do anything in the world for. And I asked him to stop drinking, and he didn't. And it broke my heart. Those years were really tough. By the time I got in junior high school, my friends were beginning to catch up to me in height, and I realized that I wasn't that weird after all. I wasn't an Amazon. I had friends that were as tall as, I'm 5'7", but I grew up really fast. And about the time that I started to identify with the girls, the boys started to identify with me, and I liked that. You know, I was looked at as a girl instead of G.I. Joe. You know, I liked it. And my dad hated it. And, but like I said, it was, those are really rough years. My dad used to embarrass me in front of my friends. A good guy would come to the house and he would say inappropriate things to my boyfriends and it would embarrass me. And, you know, things like, don't touch my girl, I know what you want. I mean, the stuff that my dad would have never said had he been sober. And, it's funny. You know, your story doesn't change, but your perception of the facts change as you've gotten sobriety. Did I tell you when I got sober? December 29th, 2003. I'm sorry. So I'm coming up on 15 years. I should have said that earlier. You should have told me to say that. I told you, God, you're supposed to tell me to say these things. But anyway, I said for a long, long time that I did what I did because I was angry at my dad because I didn't want to live at home anymore. And that's partly true, but I was fell in love with this boy when I was like 14. And, God, I wanted that boy so bad. Everybody wanted this boy so bad. And Miss Determination here, well, I got him. God loved me. I got him. But my dad could not stand him, and I really didn't care. And we decided that if I got pregnant, they'd have to let us get married. This is back in the 70s, you know? And we'll have this little baby. I mean, before we're 16 years old. We'll have this little baby. We will take it to Panama City with all of our friends when school gets out, and we'll play with it on the beach. Everybody's just going to love on it, and, you know, we're going to have this wonderful life. Did we ever think about where we were going to live or how we were going to live? No. But I got pregnant, and it wasn't an accident. It took almost 9 months for me to get pregnant. And we did. We got married. Back then, you had to quit school. I was a straight-A student. I was a cheerleader. I was in church every time the doors opened. I sang solos in church. I was a good girl. But I wanted something. The only way I could figure out to get it was to get it. So I did. And anyway, he was gone by the time my daughter was born. He was there for her birth, and you know, he didn't want to be a daddy, and all those little pipe dreams went out the window for him very quickly. And so we were living with my parents. And of course he was not. And my daughter was born, and when she was a month old, well, actually when she was about 2 weeks old, my dad, this is the thing that I want people to understand. My daddy never gave me a handout, ever. I never accepted a penny of help from anyone. The way I was brought up was that you are responsible for your decisions. And my daddy never paid, never had a credit card in his life, paid cash. Only thing he ever had on credit was a mortgage. And I grew up with that kind of mentality that it was up to me to make this work. So my daddy brought in this application for this new sewing plant that was coming to town. When Akira was about 2 weeks old, and I applied, I lied about my age, and I got a job. And I went to work when she was 4 weeks old. And I worked for 41 years straight after that. But it was tough. I was promoted. Boy, I'll tell you, I could sew. And it was $1.60 an hour. It was minimum wage. I brought home $55 a week. Daycare was $25. They promoted me to second shift manager because I was exceeding quota in how I sold, and I think that I was just making a lot more per hour than they were wanting to pay. And I was really good at teaching people how to do things. And so I was a second shift manager, and that was getting really rough because I would leave my daughter at the daycare about 2:30 or 3, and my dad would pick her up when he got off work. And when I say my dad was my daughter's dad, basically. He did all the caregiving when it came to my daughter. My mother was not interested. She loved her, but she wasn't interested in being a mama again. So my dad would pick her up, feed her, bathe her, put her to bed. I'd get off at 11, 11:30, and it would start all over again, and it was just becoming too much. My dad told me that my mother said that I was disrupting the house and that someone was going to have to change. And so my dad put a mortgage. He put a down payment on this little bitty house. The roaches wore tennis shoes. It was a safe place, but I can tell you it was a dump. But I could afford the little mortgage payment, which was $55 a month. So I'm working in a sewing plant. I go back to first shift. I work in the sewing plant, and I'm spending everything I have. He did say if you will divorce him, I will co-sign for a car. And so my dad paid for the divorce and co-signed for the car. So I had $25 a week child care, $55 a month mortgage. I had utilities. I had my little car payment. I didn't eat. I'm just telling you, I didn't eat. My daughter ate, but I would go to my parents on the weekends and so I could eat. And I'd go on Friday night and I'd leave on Sunday afternoon, and they never knew it. I would never have let them think that I wasn't doing it, and I was okay. And so one day I was at my parents' house and these two policemen come to the door and they've got a warrant for my arrest. And what for? And they said, well, you come down to the police station and we'll tell you. So my dad talked them into letting me, him take me down there. And I'm telling you, I was 17 at this time. And as we were driving to the police department, he was giving me hell. What have you done? What did you do? And I was like, Daddy, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Well, we got down there, and I had written a bad check to a grocery store. I didn't know it was a bad check. I mean, I've never kept a checkbook in my life, you know? I didn't know it was a bad check. So my dad said, can I call the store and see if they'll accept a check from me? And so they did. We stopped. He wrote a check to Warehouse Groceries. We're driving back to their house, and my dad has these tears rolling down his face. And he didn't say anything. But Monday, when I got home from work, when my daddy had gotten off, he came, pulled in my driveway, and he opened his trunk, and he started walking in with bags of groceries. And he said, as long as you are doing everything in the world you can do for yourself, I will do anything in the world I can do to help you. And he said, and you are doing everything in the world you can do for yourself. And you will never need to be hungry. And you'll never have to worry about where you're going to live. And that, I don't know, you know, Father's Day, my daughter's birthday was Wednesday. This is all a very emotional week for me. My daughter's 45 now. But this week every year brings me back to that period of my life. And I still never asked for anything, but I always went home with groceries on Sunday. You know, there was always a gallon of milk, and there were always canned food, and there was baby food, and you know, but he had no idea how hard it had been on me. So I kept getting better jobs. I left the sewing plant, and you know, one thing he said to me that made all the difference in the world to me is he said that he told me, Ginger, you have a really big brain in that head of yours. He said, and the only thing that will ever prevent you from being exactly what you want to be is going to be you. And I'll never forget that. And so I had the confidence, because of his unconditional love and support, to apply for bigger and better jobs. And I continued to do that. I never applied for a job I didn't get. I never got a job I really thought I was capable of doing. But I did it. And this high school dropout with a GED wound up with a career paying me insane amounts of money. I'm retired now, but that's all because of the confidence that my father gave me. That was all because he believed in me, and I started to kind of have a little bit of belief in myself when it came to doing things that I didn't think I could do because of him. I was single for 10 years until my daughter was 10 years old, and I married. And I was with him for 12 years. I was married for 10 of those. There was a big difference in age. He was 7 years younger than me, 10 years older than my daughter. It was like having 2-3 generations in the house. they really didn't like that each other that much. There was no arguing in our home, but they both wanted all of me, and that's impossible. So what happened was my dad died when I was 34. And I see it now, but I didn't see it then, but he was my higher power. My dad was my higher power. And when my dad died, everything comfortable in my life died with him. It was the most painful thing I've ever been through in my life. And in a period of 6 years, I started circling the drain emotionally, and I still had a great job, and I was still doing the deal when it came to work. But I can tell you that I was completely lost. I was scared to death. I felt so alone. And I found alcohol when I was 40. To go back a little bit, the first time I drank, I was 14. I had a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, and I drank every drop of it. The second time I drank a pitcher of margaritas when I was 21, and I drank every bit of it. I never had an off button, but I didn't drink until I was 40. The biggest part was I didn't have the money or the time. And my friends were off doing all that stuff when I was raising a child. And my husband didn't drink. So it was not, it just wasn't part of my life. But I walked out on my husband and my daughter. And by that time, she was married. And my son-in-law and my grandson lived in the house. And I was traveling. And I was down in Fairhope, Alabama. And I rented an apartment. And I went back and I said, I'm leaving. And I did. I left. And I started drinking. I realized after about 3 months what a mistake I'd made. My daughter begged me to come back home, and I moved back to Birmingham, and my husband didn't want to have anything to do with me because I had basically devastated him. And so there takes my drinking off. And I'm telling you, I don't do anything a little bit. my mother had suggested that I go back to church, and I was Baptist, and so I know Baptists don't drink, so I joined a Methodist church. You know, I mean, if you change your religion because of your drinking habits, you might have a problem. So I joined a singles group in a Methodist church because they drank and they socialized and they went to bars together, and I met my next Mr. Wright at a bar. And all of his friends drank. And so there was my life off to the races with that's all we did was drink, 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 drink. Everything we did had to do with alcohol. And those are my drinking public years. Those are the years that I got pulled over on the interstate for speeding and consequently for DUI, and the guy put me on the side of the interstate, and this is a busy interstate. It's Interstate 65. Wham! 18 wheelers up and down the road, and he's telling me to walk hill toe down a line with my hands out, and I scream at him, "Are you crazy? I'm drunk. You're going to get me killed." And so, I mean, there you go. And then he puts, you know how they put your hand on someone's head to put in the back of the police car. I mean, I turn into the exorcist and swivel my head around and say, "Don't touch my hair." You know, I mean, that was, who are you to touch me? Do you know who I am? So I spent a night in jail and several thousand dollars worth of fines in DUI school and community service. And I would drink the minute I could leave DUI school. I had no intention of stopping drinking because I was just in a bad place at the bad time, and that's what all my friends told me. It could have been any of us. So I continued to drink. I got rid of that loser. I don't know which was the biggest loser, but let's just say we parted ways. And I had a lake house, and one of my other drunken public stories was I had a lake house, and I love to fish. And I would sit on that pier, and I would fish at night because I love to fish for catfish because they fight, and I like a fight. So I would sit on the pier at night with my beer, and I would fish until I knew it was time to pass out. I always made it to the, almost always made it to the pass out point, which was hopefully a bed. Well, one night I was fishing on the pier, and I cast my reel, and my reel goes with it. And I hate lake water. It's like Jaws is down there or something. But I dove in to get my reel because it was my best fishing pole. And I come up on the pier, soaking wet. And my intention was to go up on the deck, which was only 30 feet from the water, take off my wet clothes, and go to bed. That was my intention. But this is what happened. I went up to the deck. I took off my clothes. That padded, sun-warm top of the hot tub must have felt really inviting. So the next thing I know, I wake up the next morning, spread eagle, butt naked, on the top of the hot tub, and I see the sun coming through the leaves, and I look at my eyes, and there are two men in a fishing boat, and they are looking at me like this. And so I laid there, and I said, "Morning." I don't know if they thought I was dead or not, but, they turned their head, and I graciously slithered off the hot tub and hid behind it until I could sneak into the cabin. So those are my drinking public stories. It was getting really bad, and in 2000, I came into AA, and I decided that it was I had to do something. And so I came in AA. I got a sponsor that I didn't love. I never picked up the book. She'd tell me to call her, and I'd call her, and I'd pray she wouldn't answer the phone. And if she didn't answer the phone, then I'd get a resentment because she didn't answer the phone, and she told me to call her. I wanted to go out and still hang out at the bar with my friends and told her I wouldn't drink and that, you know, I didn't have a desire to and that I was over it. And she told me that I was full of, and I got mad at her. And so I went out on a date, and a guy asked me if I'd like to have a drink before while we were waiting for dinner. And I said, sure. And that's how quickly my disease stepped back in because I'd done nothing to heal myself. And I know he told me, because he said it several times, I had four Long Island iced teas. And then we went to a bar. And I don't know how many beers I had, but I know I woke up with a stranger in my bed the next morning, which was not me. It was not the kind of person I was, and I was so humiliated and devastated that I drank for the next 2.5 years. And I just about drank myself to death. I work from my home office, which is a very dangerous place for an alcoholic to work. I would get up in the morning, I would drink. I would drink until I realized that my voice was probably getting a little slurry, and I would take my lunch, which was like an hour and a half nap or 2 hours, and then I would return phone calls, and I would start drinking again, and I would drink until I passed out in bed. And I did that for 2.5 years. And when I was traveling, I was white knuckling every minute I had to stay sober. I never stayed in a hotel that didn't have room service. I never took a direct flight because I needed a buzz at a bar between the flight. Alcohol absolutely controlled my life. And how I kept my job, I have no idea, except for the fact that I worked from my home office. And I knew my drinking patterns enough to, I didn't drink with customers. When it got really bad, I quit drinking around my employees. I quit drinking around customers. I just knew I couldn't handle it anymore. And so it gets to the what happened part of my story. What happened was my brother was in recovery, and he'd been sober for 7 years. And in 2003, he asked me if I would come to Orlando to a New Year's Eve party and be his date. God, I'm from Alabama, but don't take it that way. That just sounded wrong when it came out, but okay. And I had watched my brother change from this miserable human being into this, to this happy, joyous, and free person in sobriety. And as his life was going higher and higher and higher, I was going lower and lower and lower. But God love him, he never said I needed to join Alcoholics Anonymous. God love him, he never said you're an alcoholic, don't call me. He just shared his life with me. And I got to see how happy he was. So I told him I would go because I thought to myself, I can stay sober one night. And when I would go see my brother, he would also let me stop and get beer and take it to his house. And he would not buy it for me, and it wouldn't be there, but he would stop and let me buy my beer. And so on the way to, when I was in the airplane, I remember this feeling, this thought, this something that said, something's going to change. I didn't think the airplane was going to crash. I had absolutely no idea what that feeling meant, but I knew something was going to happen. And I got to his house that night. We stopped and got a sandwich and my beer, sat there, and I started drinking beer. I had also been sipping on a lot of cough medicine because I was sick, and so I had a constant buzz. I will tell you that my last few years of drinking, I call top-off drinking, because alcohol was always in my system. I was only topping it off. That's what I was doing for 2.5 years. So I was top-off drinking, and so I had already had plenty before getting ready, on the way to, during the short flight, cough syrup. And so I bought the beer, and I was sitting there at his house watching Johnny Depp, Pirates of the Caribbean, Black Pearl, and I remember seeing like 3 Johnny Depps. And I said, I gotta go to bed. Okay, sis. So the next morning I get up, and when he walks in the kitchen, I'm pouring out my beer in the sink. And he said, what are you doing, sis? And I said, I want what you have, but I don't know how to get it. And he said, are you willing to go to any length? And I said, yes. He said, are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? And I said, yes. And he said, let's pray. And I said, I don't have anything to pray to. My brother had lost his leg in a motorcycle accident coming home from an AA meeting. And I can tell you, I was so angry at God. You have no idea, because he was doing everything right. And yet this happened to him. And so I had no faith in a God, a loving God. And he prayed for me. And he said, I pray for the obsession of alcohol to be removed from Ginger. And it was. And I went to that New Year's Eve party with him, and I had 2 days of sobriety. We worked the first 3 steps together. I had 2 days of sobriety, and we got there, and it was full of chairs. There's probably 500 chairs lined up in this huge place. And I said, I thought this was a party. And he said, I think they're going to have a meeting first. I said, okay. So, that was fine with me. I was sick. I was so weak. I had been going through DTs for 2 days. I mean, I was just, I couldn't sleep. I jittered. Skin was crawling. I had detox real bad. And so we sat in the second row from the front, and they started doing this thing called the sobriety countdown. I had no idea what this was. But they'd say, anybody with 45 years or more sobriety, stand up. And then they go, 40 years, stand up. And then they would keep doing that. My brother stood up at 7 years, and I stood up at 2 days. It's all good. And they said, anybody with 45 years or more sobriety, sit down. Anybody with 40 years, sit down. And everybody started sitting down. And my brother sat down at 7 years. And I looked at him, and I said, I'm going to kill you. And he said, you can sit down whenever you want to. And that determination, no way, Jose, I'm staying here. So they got down to 7 days, and it was me and one other woman in the very back of the room that was standing up. And they went 7 days, and 500 heads went this way. And 6 days, and they go this way, and they got to 2 days, and I sat down. She had 1 day of sobriety. I came back to Birmingham, and he says, you get yourself in a meeting. And I did. He said, you find yourself a sponsor. And I did. And I've never wanted anything as much in my life as I wanted sobriety. And I was willing to feel as uncomfortable as I had to feel for sobriety. And I got a sponsor, and she was 27, and I was 47, but she had 10 years of sobriety, and this girl had what I wanted. There was something about her that I just wanted. And whatever she asked me to do, I did. The reason I do the jail now is because the very first service work I ever did, she told me to meet her at the Hoover City Jail, and I was taking a meeting in there. And I had no idea what I was doing, but she taught me right away that I was supposed to be doing things for other people. And you wouldn't believe this now, but when I came into AA, I didn't say a word. I know you don't believe it, if you know me, but I wouldn't say a word. My career was basically public speaking. I could give presentations in front of 100, 1,000 people. It didn't faze me. I could do training classes. It didn't faze me. I could make sales calls. It didn't faze me because I was sharing knowledge. I was not sharing me. One thing I had never done in my life was share me. And I didn't know how to share me with anybody anymore. And so I didn't say a word, but on Tuesday nights, there was a big book study. And you would go around the room and you would read a paragraph and you'd share on it. And then you'd read a paragraph and you'd share on it. Well, I would count the people ahead of me and count down to the chapter, the paragraph I would be reading. And I'd be reading that and be preparing for my presentation. So then came the week that the woman in front of me had a one-sentence paragraph, and she read my paragraph. And I didn't have time to prepare with the next paragraph, so I read it, and I shared on it. And after the meeting, I told my sponsor, I said, how did I sound when I shared tonight? She said, fine. What do you mean? I said, I didn't know what to say. And she said, well, you share every week. And I said, no, you don't understand. That girl in front of me read my paragraph. I wasn't prepared. So she said, so what you're saying is, while other people are reading the big book and sharing, you're not listening to them. You're preparing your paragraph. And I went, no. And she said, don't do that. Share from your heart, not your head. You've been sharing from your head your whole life. You've got to learn to share from your heart. I have never shared in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I have not shared from my heart. I usually share early in a meeting because it's on my heart and I want to say it. I want to hear what you have to say. I share from my heart. We're almost up on the hour. I want to get to one thing that's happened. Yeah, in many, many years of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was rocking and rolling. I had a wonderful life. And then something happened that devastated me, that pulled the rug out from under my life as I knew it. And I can tell you that every one of those meetings I've gone to for 12 years, I needed at that point in my life. Every story I heard you share about how you got through something that was difficult in your life, I needed at that point in my life. Every friendship I've made over all these years, I needed during that period of my life. And a lot of you women are sitting here tonight, and I can tell you that if it hadn't been for the women that knew me and were there to support me, I would have drowned. I would have drowned. Am I sorry it happened? It wasn't fun. But I can tell you that because it happened, it forced my butt into gear. And there was something in my life that had happened when I was a child that it forced me to seek outside help for. And I always knew I had this character trait, but I never knew why. I didn't know what to do about it, and I didn't know how to change it. And so I went for outside help. And thank God I did. Because now I know how not to repeat same behaviors I've repeated my whole life. I also found that God of my understanding is the same characteristics my father had. My God is unconditional love. My God is with me every minute of every day. My God will always be there to hold me up, whether I can see him or not. And I depended on that God that I really didn't know existed more than I ever had in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. It saved my life in 2003, and it saved my life in 2016. And it will save my life again, because I know that my trials and tribulations are not over, and neither are yours. Things happen to all of us. And what happened to me in 16 is not nearly as bad as what I have seen people live through in Alcoholics Anonymous and get through and stay sober and find joy again. It's possible because I've seen it happen. I want to end with a story. This is the other thing I didn't want to forget, so I'm batting 1,000. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous means to me. There was a man walking on the beach, and up ahead he saw another man bending down and scooping something up from the sand and throwing it in the ocean over and over and over. And the man walks up and he gets closer and sees that there are starfish laying all over the beach. And the man says, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I'm throwing these starfish back in the ocean." And he said, "Why?" He said, "Because if I don't, they'll die." And the other man said, "But there are millions of them out there in the ocean. What possible difference could you make?" And the man looks at the starfish that he's holding in his hand, and he said, "It makes all the difference in the world to this one." Alcoholics Anonymous and you meant all the difference in the world to me. Thank you. All right.